Hey, Mike.
Hey, Michelle, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great.
Great's great.
Welcome to West Coast Project and episode 309, Aporia for Fargo.
Yeah. What'd you think?
Michelle, I tried and tried to find the meaning of this damn word. I looked a million places and tried to find it in a way that I could repeat it back so I sounded like I knew a little bit at least of what I knew I was talking about. And the very best thing I could find was its use, the example of its being used in a sentence.
Okay.
And so here's the sentence.
Okay.
Having been reduced to the realization that he did not know, he will go on and discover something. So you have to be presented with an argument enough for you to convince yourself that, hey, I'm ignorant about this. And that will open the door for you to be able to figure it out and go on and discover something.
Huh. Okay.
So synonyms of aporia or the aporetic. First of all, I'm telling you, man, I put way too much time into this. The etymology of the word aporia, a is without and poria is passage. So without passage. So you have to find a way to understand that you don't have the passage. You don't have the definition. So synonyms are questioning, cynical, leery, quizzical, skeptical, incredulous, mistrustful. And of course, our beloved, what is the meaning of this?
I swear I cannot think of that without genuinely laughing every single time.
So the closest thing I could dial into the episode here is modamic being aporetic, like anti-aporial, by knowing that he knows the answer when he shouldn't know the answer, right? He has evidence, and he's convinced he knows the answer when this evidence should make him scratch his head and say, wait a minute, these things all don't add up quite like they should.
Okay, because I got the word aphorism, right? I'm not even sure now, though, if that's even like
that's a different word.
It is a completely different word?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I thought it was like use of the word or, you know, taking aporia into, you know, like a statement or something.
Well,
are you sure it's not?
Let me look that up now.
Because aphorism is a statement of truth or opinion expressed in a concise and witty manner. And I know that's not exactly what aporia is, as you look up like the definition or something, but if you go into aphorisms, it's stuff like those who mind don't matter and those who matter don't mind. It's like little quips like that, which is, of course, what we saw the Widow Goldfarb doing when she had that conversation with Gloria. So I could have just borrowed this and like used it in its stead since I heard that.
I know that word more is aphorism.
Okay.
So aporia, and it sounds kind of like it. Without going into a whole etymology black hole here, I'm not quite sure if they're connected.
Okay.
And maybe we should know that because you're right. She does get into that kind of robotic recital of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's another saying.
Right. A statement that's either truth or opinion, but it's expressed in a concise and witty manner. And it says for it to be an aphorism. Is that how you said it? Aphorism?
Aphorism.
It's necessary for a statement to contain a truth, but it's revealed in a real terse manner. Like she was saying, what did she say? I just drew a blank. But the Widow Goldfarb had several.
When it rains, it pours. Yeah, she was.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Right.
I think they're different. I want to say okay. I think they're different. I mean, probably apologetic. Probably a, you know, anti without a.
Right, right.
Asymmetrical, you know, things that mean the opposite of what the remainder of the word defines. So maybe aphorism is close to aporetic, but I'm not sure that they're quite the same.
Yeah, okay, maybe not.
But anyway, I tried my best to attach it to something in this episode, and modamic was the closest I could get. So, Michelle, another thing. First of all, how'd you like this episode?
I really liked it. It was so content-filled that I feel like we could have another one of those ridiculously long episodes if we're not careful. But I really did like it. What'd you think?
Well, I think the review of this one is much less philosophical than it is plot and drama. Like some things were, a lot was revealed.
A lot was revealed. But, you know, I mean, that's what I like. And then going into all of the stuff that was revealed, it's like, it's a lot of stuff, I thought.
Yeah, but it's less interpretive, I think, than last week. I really loved last week. And I really like this one, too. So I like both strategies of storytelling. But, Michelle, I thought it would be fun to listen to how Mr. Wrench is released by Lauren Malvo in season one.
Oh, okay.
So I'll give you, this is about a 2 minute, I'll play it back. It's about a 2 minute little dialogue that, of course, Mr. Wrench doesn't say anything. But Malvo, the first part of the scene, Malvo strangles a cop in the bathroom with a belt around the neck and holds his feet. And he kicks his feet like in No Country for Old Men, the cop kicking his feet.
Right.
And he... Then he gets into the hospital and he talks to Wrench. And here's what happens.
Okay.
Never heard of a deaf hitman. Carolina Murphy had his tongue cut out by an Indian back in the 80s. He worked a little after that, but never quite the same. And Buzz Mead, you know Buzz? He was born with just a socket. He used to take his glass eye out at parties and drop it in his drink. He's a shit shot, though. Now, yeah, the other fellow, your partner, he can hear just fine. We had a kind of a chat before I cut his throat.
Wrench is handcuffed to a gurney, so that's a struggle.
You're unemployed now, by the way. In case you don't read the papers. I watched a bear once. His leg was in a steel trap. It chewed through bloody bone to get free. It was in Alaska. And died about an hour later. Face down in a stream. It was on his own terms, you know? Closer than anybody else.
He stands up and throws the handcuff key onto his chest.
I don't know if it was you or your partner, but look, if you still feel raw about things, when you heal up, come see me.
And then he leaves. So, I think... do you remember that scene, Michelle?
I do. I remember the story about the bear chewing his own leg off to get free. That was what clicked back in my memory. So, yeah.
So, I really like this inference about you got close, you know, like you almost got to me. Like he's got to be some sort of avenging angel already. Like, Nikki has kind of been granted the status of avenging angel by, you know, by what's his name? Paul?
Paul, mm-hmm.
And Wrench is now her partner. So somehow, I just love this concept that there's some great being setting forces in motion to help defeat evil, I guess is the most philosophical way to think of it. But this was way back in season one.
Right.
So Wrench has been, you know, really a pretty important part of the story. And I mean, who'd have thunk it, right, at the beginning of season three?
Oh, I know, Wrench, of all people. I don't know if I remember what he did in season two. Do you remember that off the top of your head?
Nothing. He was just a little kid, that the Indian guy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
They say he was the only one in all three seasons, but he was really just a short little scene with him as a little kid.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't know. That was cool to go back and relive that. So, but not a great day for Stussy's in this episode, Michelle.
No, last name Stussy, pretty bad. And it was pretty amazing the links that the Varga clan, or whatever you might call them, will go to get their way. It was a little shocking, even though, I mean, I've seen stuff, but every time they do this kind of stuff, it's just in such conflict with the guy sitting on a commode eating, you know, shoveling ice cream down his throat, to being the guy who will, you know, just destroy innocent, completely innocent people's lives just to make a point. But there's a lot of things in this, though, that were kind of telling. So
are you comfortable with the timeline? Like, do you think it's much farther than this March 15th time jump that we had from last episode? Like, Nikki's kind of healed up and spry, and she's beaten an arrow through the leg, you know, not too long ago. You think that's pretty believable?
I think it's believable. I tried to find the date on the newspaper in the first scene, but I couldn't find one. So, evidently, they don't really want us to know, as far as I could tell.
So, as theories, as my old friend Jamie used to say, shit, I wish I said, or wish I said that shit. This happened to me a lot from the last episode, too, Michelle. And I think I texted you a couple thoughts, like, in the middle of the night, as they came to me. But one, with the guy Paul in the pool, in the bowling alley. But I was calling it a pool hall. It's a bowling alley. I think he didn't let Nikki keep the cat because Ray... the cat is in a different place in time or space than Nikki had to be. So that told me that I think Nikki is alive, because you can't take the dead guy with you because you're still on Earth doing earthly things. And Ray's in the process of becoming this spirit embodied into the cat. And we didn't see that with Yuri. And also, Wrench left with Nikki. So that made me kind of rethink the fact that I kind of thought they were alive, but that kind of made me sure that they were alive.
Yeah, that absolutely made more sense once I started thinking. I mean, you know, it's nonsensical a concept as it even is, but it showed the separation of Ray and Nikki, and we know Ray is gone.
Right. So, and then the fact that Yuri saw those real people, or, you know, real, whatever, he saw those people, the pogrom victims that were slaughtered back in the 1600s or 1700s, that meant that because he could see them and he had to stay and deal with them, that he's probably dead. So, I don't know, that kind of cooked in me for two or three days, and I baked and came out that way, and that's what I attached to it.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely buy that, although I'm not completely... Yuri didn't seem like he was hurt bad enough to die, from what we could tell. So,
he was gushing blood, though. He was gurgling blood up from... I know it's probably his ear, but...
I mean, gurgling?
It was flowing from his... It was flowing down his front of his shirt.
Ears are very vascular. Amazingly vascular sometimes, or, well, I guess I shouldn't say that. I know they are in dogs, so, I mean, I'm going to assume that they are. But still, I mean, you know, you apply some pressure. I didn't see any specific thing that looked like an arterial
pressure. He never showed up again. It's months later, and he saw the people that were dead as ghosts that he had to face the wrath of. You know, I think he's dead.
Yeah, but at the same time, you kind of didn't think he was ever human to die. So I think you know, if he was the guy, the Yuri that they were looking for back in episode one of this season, then he was never human in here anyway. So I think we kind of have that little mystery going with it too.
Well, maybe like Ray and the cat, Yuri's soul was transported from Yuri to Yuri to Yuri, you know, or similar like characters in history to play this role of this bad guy that he has always seemed to be. And now he's facing the wrath of the people that he had put down.
Or if that's the case, maybe he'll come back later.
All right, Michelle, you won't let me have it, will you?
Okay. Okay, you're right. You're right. He's gone.
All right. So what about the conversations? Great conversations between Emmett and Gloria.
Yep.
And then V&V and Nikki.
Yep.
And then Gloria and Winnie.
Yes.
It seems like a lot gets moved ahead by two people talking.
Yeah, there was a lot of really, really telling conversation in this episode, and still a lot to wrap up, considering that we have just one episode left, don't you think?
I think they're going to get there, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have no doubt that they will, but I couldn't find anywhere. Is it supposed to be a longer episode, or is it going to be just the normal hour?
I don't know.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's a lot to wrap up in an hour. I have no doubt they'll be able to do it, but it just seems like a lot.
So, Keith Gordon directed this, Michelle. Keith Gordon has directed The Leftovers this season of The Leftovers and Better Call Saul this season.
Oh, wow.
He's also directed Walking Dead in the past, The Killing, Dexter, Homeland. He's got about 25 directorial credits, so he's a really kind of renowned director. And that's about all the preface I got, unless you have anything else before we start our recap.
No, you pretty much covered it, I think. But we start this episode, so we're at this different house. We don't know who it is. It's 818 something. That's all we know. I didn't know if that was going to be important. I'm taking these notes as I'm watching it. And some guy goes out to get the paper, and he's got sprinklers going off in the snow. That was weird, wasn't it?
You got to water your lawn.
You gotta water your snow. I would think the snow would be water in the lawn. Anyway, he comes back in and he goes to the refrigerator and Mimo's there. And that's the end of this guy. His blood mixes with milk on the floor. We see Mimo stab him with, we find out later, a piece of glass. I wasn't sure at the time. And it goes up to the newspaper that's laying on the counter, and his name happens to be Marvin Stussy, and he's at 818 Elmhurst Drive in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
So that milk flowing into the blood, or blood flowing into the milk, whichever it was, that was Keith Gordon's input. That was not in the script. That was his directorial addition to the story.
Oh, really? That was... it really caused me to take notice of it for some reason. I thought that was, I really paid attention to that for whatever reason. I thought that was great in place of, I mean, it wasn't great. It was horrifying, but it really captured my attention, that detail. Did you notice it specifically too?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the meanwhile, as per usual, Fargo, we have this weird, upbeat, fiddly music playing in the background, and the intro flashes across the screen during all this. I have to say, I told you that I didn't really have anything, you know, to begin with, but the music, I did want to point out before we get too deep into it, the music in this made me a nervous wreck. They have taken the music and made it like, it's been weird the whole season, but it was very... mania inducing, I felt like, in this episode. They're giving us tastes of what Mimo's listening to at different times, and it's always just this, you know, the kind of music that it feels, there's always something else going on in the scene when you're hearing this. Just it, the music feels invasive, and it just feels really fast, and it feels like another something else trying to grab your attention as everything else is going on. And it's just me. I just thought I'd point that out because I've caught myself a couple times just really trying to tune out the music and having a hard time doing it.
Yeah. It's usually not misleading though. It's usually indicative of what is about to come.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And it was happening during those scenes, the scenes that a lot was going on, but the music, of course, the volume would go up. And it was just felt really intrusive. I don't know if you've been, you know, like in a house and you got like a lot of people talking at one time and stuff like that. And you just get to the point that you feel like you can't concentrate on everything all around you at one time. And I was really like having some of those kind of manic feelings with this music this time. And I don't know why. I don't think I've done that before. Even if the music has, you know, taken me somewhere in the context of the episode, it's never been, it felt very invasive to me in this. It felt like it was part of the chaos that was going on. And I don't know, it was brilliantly done, but it was incredibly annoying, painful almost at times to have to hear that music on top of everything else. So, but I might be the only person that felt that. I don't know.
How did you like the Emmett Mirror to Eternity scene where he's sitting in front of, I guess, mirrors facing each other to make that effect?
In the police station?
Yeah, this next scene.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt like he was... I'm worried about Emmett. I don't think Emmett... I wouldn't be surprised if Emmett doesn't come out of this the worst for wear. And I think we maybe could have guessed that. It's not like I'm revealing anything huge, but I don't see how. You know how you'll be like reading a Stephen King book or something, and it gets to the point that the character in this book is, you know, that's the end of them. It's like the point of no return. They get to a point and you know, okay, this person's not going to come back from this. And I'm kind of getting that feeling with Emmett in this. And I could be wrong, of course, but I just feel like he is so entrapped.
No, there's no redemption for Emmett. There's no salvation for Emmett. So, and he's kind of he's shuffled to the side now. He's not that important of a character.
Do you think they're going to have a time jump in the last episode?
I have no idea. To show Emmett an old man happy with Stella.
Stella, no. No, I don't think so based on what I saw for the next episode. But I
don't
just
care
curious.
That much about Emmett, really, to tell you the truth. I care about Winnie and Gloria. I care about Nikki. Now Wrench, of all people. I don't care about Emmett too much. I don't, you know, it doesn't really mean that much to me.
I feel bad for Emmett. I think Emmett has just gotten in incredibly over his head, and I don't think he meant to do that. And I feel like his heart, you know, he tries to do the right thing at this point anyway. I don't know. But anyway, he's in the police station with Gloria, and she has a video camera and a tape player. She offers him a Coke, a drink, a soda. And this is where we find out that it's March 16th. 2011.
Okay, so it's only a day after March 15th when the nurse wrote on Sy's board in the last episode.
That's right. But still, we don't know how much time has passed since the bus... Well, yeah, we do, don't we? Because the bus wreck was Christmas Day. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so never mind everything we said before. It is. It's March 16th, 2011. They're in the Meeker County Sheriff's Office now. And I'm not sure where this Meeker County Sheriff's Office came from. Did I miss something? I know that they got absorbed, Gloria's division department did.
Well, maybe they're in the county office instead of the city of whatever Gloria was, where the library and the police were the same. Maybe they're now in the county police building. Okay.
Well, she asked why he came all the way here in place of... because she's an hour away and there's three other St. Cloud Metros between her and him. And he said, because you gave me your card. I thought that was
well, that's
like,
why. Then it's not even Gloria's precinct.
Well, it is her. That's where she works. Remember, she was working up there doing the...
Then how can she be an hour away?
An hour away from him. I don't think that means an hour away from what? What do you mean?
Well, I took it like she came an hour away to get to that building.
No, I don't think so. Because this is where she was last week when he came walking in, and that's where she was working doing the eviction notices. Remember
so,
when
so
she
Emmett's
signed
an
him?
Hour away.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Emmett says that if anyone comes claiming to be his lawyer, don't believe him. Don't let him in. He has that whole conversation. And then he goes into a lot of stuff, right? He's saying things like, a lie isn't a lie if you think it's true. And he asks Gloria if she believes that, and she says this is not her story.
Yeah, but it is her story, Michelle, because she's the direct believer of a lie being true. A lie is not a lie if you believe it's true. She's married to a gay guy. She believed what she wanted to believe, and that made it true for her, even though it was essentially a lie.
Hmm. Okay. Well, he says he tricked Ray, and he begins talking about their father and how their father, I mean, I don't know if I should even go into everything. Should we talk about every little bit that he went into? Because it was like a lot of stuff, you know? But basically, he's talking about his father and Chubby Ray, and that his father played tennis, and he goes into what happened as his father died, and he's really upset, of course, as you would be about this, that he was doing something he wasn't supposed to do, which was bouncing a ball against the side of the house, and his dad came back from playing tennis and just dropped. And then he's kind of going back and forth between his dad and Ray as he's talking. He's like, I killed him. And she says, your dad? And he says, no, Ray. And then he goes into the den of Ray's apartment is where he killed him. And then he gets this philosophical question of, do you think there's a special level of hell for people who kill their loved ones on Christmas Eve?
Yeah. I think the meaning of this is that essentially he says, I killed Ray for 30 years. I've been killing him for 30 years.
Oh, I know. Yeah, that was pretty profound.
And only the time he fell a couple days ago, but I've been killing him for 30 years.
Right. Well, he says that he was 17 and Ray was 15 when his dad dies. And then we get the whole story on the car versus the stamps. He's like, you know, you wouldn't expect a 17-year-old to want the stamps, but I did. And he was talking about how Ray was a virgin, and he kind of made the car seem like a way to get girls.
Yeah.
And then he had Ray asking him to trade. He tricked Ray, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, I like that, and they cleared this up.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that you and I talked about it a lot at the beginning about whether, you know, he actually tricked him or what went on. But, I mean, I guess he did trick him, right? I mean, and he feels guilty about it.
It also explains that Emmett's empire is built on this money, seed money he got from the stamp money.
Exactly.
Another theme in Fargo, by the way, too. It's like the grocery king got his money by finding the suitcase of money that was from the Fargo movie in the snow and started his supermarket kingdom. So ill-gotten money has started these empires that they look good on the surface. Oh, well, about man about town, family man, got a nice clean mansion, affluent guy, you know, provider to the community, gives probably jobs at his parking lots, but that was ill-begotten money, I would
sure
call.
Yeah, absolutely, money that, yeah, absolutely. But Emmett even feels bad about, like, hanging the stamp up. He's talking about how he kept the 1 2-cent stamp, and he hung it up where Ray could see it,
in
and what
face.
That must have meant to Ray, right? And then he makes that comment about 30 years I've been killing him, but this is just when he fell. And that was like, wow. You know? That was,
yeah, that clears that all up, though. I like that. There's not, well, was Ray the bad guy or was Emmett the bad? You know, they both had motivations that were not totally generous. They were self-serving motivations.
But I'm going to say something that I hate to have to say, but he goes in there confessing to murder, and he really didn't murder Ray. He really didn't. This is a guilt thing. Mo is right. This is a guilt thing. This was just an accident. And if you look at how it happened, it was as much, probably a little bit more, Ray's fault than it was Emmett's fault.
Yeah, he does go in there to clear his conscience, for sure. But he explains it. She gets him to explain exactly what happened. you know, were you, did you stab him? And it was like, no, we were both fighting back and forth, and it was kind of a manslaughter less than a murder.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even call it a manslaughter. I would call it an accident. What if they'd been playing, you know, in place of pushing it, you know, back and forth? There was no malintent in any way. And, you know, Mo is right also that this is just what Gloria wants to pin on him, because she heard this story and she's still calling it murder. So
I don't know,
Michelle,
isn't
right.
that the definition of manslaughter? It's like,
well,
no,
I guess
intent.
It is. Well,
there was a lot of exsanguination there. You got to admit that.
But, well, true. But I don't know if it was even manslaughter, because I know he died, but I don't know if it was Emmett's fault at all. Do you? I mean,
no,
if Emmett hadn't
call it
been
Emmett's
there.
Fault, but I. Whatever it is, it got cleared up, and maybe it'll help us as viewers figure out a little bit more about the relationship between Ray and Emmett, which I think it did. I think it did for me anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Because but at the same time, I'm kind of curious the way Emmett's looking back on it, if it's not just guilt talking, because he's saying things, he's projecting too much on himself. Oh, well, I murdered him.
That's what guilt does to people, though.
Yeah, but how much more is he maybe projecting?
Well, that's what
on
guilt does
how he
to,
treated him over
point.
The years.
Guilt makes you take on more. This was always my fault. So more of it's my fault than it really was, you know, really was.
Right. Well, then we see VMV and Mimo, and they're talking about getting Emmett to sign papers. And then he says, go straight to stage 4, no mistakes. Of course, we don't know what that means. And Mimo gets in the truck, and VMV is in a smaller truck behind him. Now, there's other people that we don't know again. So
you
there's
know
other
VMV
people.
VMV was in the SUV behind him? I didn't catch that. I saw the Blazer or whatever following the semi, but I didn't know exactly who was in it.
I know that he got into, there was two vehicles that actually followed the big, that actually pulled out of the lot with the big truck. One was a car and one was that smaller truck that was behind him. So, no, I don't know. I'm not sure. I thought he did, but I'm not sure that he's the one who got shot at in a little while. So, I'm not sure if that's true.
Please
but,
stick
I mean,
with the facts, Michelle.
Okay, sorry. But the truck's going down the road. It gets stopped at a red light outside a bar. And this is where I made a note here that you could hear Mimo's music playing in the headphones. And it was just driving me crazy because it was such a tense scene. And then the window breaks. The grenade is thrown into a cab by Nikki. And Mimo and the other guy jump out and run. And Wrench comes along and he's like shooting at the car behind him. It was a great scene. And Mimo's jumping in the back of that truck, the bed of that truck, and Nikki gets in the front of this 18-wheeler and pulls off.
And yeah, then, so Nikki, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, literally drove that truck, according to the director, Gordon.
Really?
So it was kind of cool. They said it was kind of cool watching little Mary Elizabeth drive this semi. So she drove that truck. She really was stepping on the gas and driving it. That's cool.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And then we see Mimo, he picks up the fake grenade and he looks at it. I was kind of curious, in a situation like that, if you would jump out or if you would grab the grenade and throw it out, which of course would have derailed their plans.
It's a little stretchy of plot there. You're right. It's a little, what the hell? Do you jump out and run, or do you just throw the grenade? I don't know. You pick up the grenade and try to throw it, blows your hand off or your arm off or kills you, whatever. It's a 50-50. I'll give them that it's believable.
Right. I'm just saying, if it had went the other way, then what would they have done? That would have been a bad situation. But then we see Nikki and Ranch, and they park the truck in a big scrapyard, it looks like, and they go into the back, and they know exactly what they're going for. And I'm not sure how they knew what they were going for. Do you know how they knew that?
Well, I mean, they probably reverse engineered the process of the Stussy business being taken over. They see that this guy, all he does is go in and out of this truck. They followed him before, right? That's how they... Didn't they know somehow before from the time that...
Nikki and Ray knew, yeah. Because remember, that's when he was going to get out and do something. So she obviously knew something was going on in the truck. And you're right. A lot of time has passed, and she could have definitely figured stuff out. But they know exactly. They don't search anything else. They go straight to the back, have to break it into this cage back there and get a briefcase out. And then they get...
They got more than that. They went to the communication center of the semi, the locked up, caged in computer room with the files and the data drives and whatever else, maybe a couple computers. They knew the information was what they wanted.
Right. And they had it all set up with a car parked there and everything ready to take off. And they get in the car and they take off.
I like how when they drove off the metal scrapyard cranes were feeding, like almost like they were feeding on the metal, the shredded metal.
Yeah, it was pretty intense looking for sure. So I guess you're right. I guess VMV was not in that truck behind because he's in the Stussy Lots building when Mimo comes in looking worse for wear, and the phone rings before Mimo can even say anything to him, and it's Nikki.
Yeah, Emmett's I call him Emmett. VMV is like Emmett. He's like Emmett now, waiting apprehensively, like, oh shit, what's gonna happen next? Like Emmett used to wait in that very room.
Right.
What's gonna happen to me next? And now VMV's in that position, which was really cool to see. It felt good on a vengeance level, like, if you want to be a selfish audience viewer and just say, all right, he's going to finally get his revenge or his vengeance upon him, this was a nice, fun scene to watch.
Yeah, because you can tell. But, I mean, you know, it's like everything else, too. You kind of worry that she's not going to have – that she doesn't know who she's dealing with.
But he doesn't know who he's dealing with.
Right. But we don't know that, really.
Yeah, because, we do.
No, we don't. I mean, I didn't. All I know about Nikki so far is that she's some kind of petty criminal who is a very good bridge player.
Well, that's important. That's very, very important in this whole thing, the bridge element.
I agree with the
strategist. We'll get to it when they talk a little bit about bridge, but she's swaying over the recidivist, Michelle. Come on, don't cut her short.
Well... Okay, I didn't mean to cut her short.
We're waiting. She calls him, I guess, is where we are.
Right. She calls him, and she starts immediately talking about his account and using account numbers, and that definitely gets his attention. I don't know if you noticed or not, but she called, when she was saying the Z's in the account numbers, she called them Zed in place of Z.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very, well, I mean, I don't know if it is. I assume it is. We've got some Canadian friends. We meet them in Florida a lot of years. When we go to Florida, we just happen to stay at the same place and meet up with them. And that's how they say Z, is Z.
Yeah, it's very British. So yeah, a la Canadian.
So that was kind of...
They also, instead of H, they say H.
Really?
H-O-R-S-E, horse, H.
Okay, I'll have to ask him about that one too. But I thought that was kind of cool to hear that. I haven't heard that. I haven't even thought about that in a couple of years. But he's got some cute lines in this and everything. You know, he's telling her if she's just going to be fresh, he's just going to go have a good lie down. And you know, he tries to be cool, but I don't think he's feeling very cool.
Well, she's also several steps ahead of him, a la the bridge analogy. He says, well, those accounts do you no good without the 6 passwords. She's like, oh, so it's 6? Thank you very much. I thought it was 5. She's done her homework, and he's revealing stuff. And then just his facial expression, David Thewlis, he's a great actor with his, of course, his freaking teeth. But just this is the first time he's looked concerned in a long time.
I agree. Yeah, he finally did. He looked well. I mean, when he was digging around in his mouth with that thing, he looked a little concerned.
That's pleasure. That's fun for him.
Oh, I don't know. But she wants. He finally gets it out of her that she wants $2 million, and to meet at the Clarion Hotel at 4 p.m. Come alone. She hangs up. And he won't tell her what the VM stands for. This seems to be like this running thing now, right? He's not going to say. And I'm wondering if we're going to find out. Because we hear this several times.
Oh, no, no. I never attached that much importance to it. But you're right. He doesn't. It is kind of cutishly kept secret.
Yeah,
but that's, I mean, all it is. That's all it is to me. Is kind of like, oh well, that's kind of cute, but I don't know that it's that important.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know either. It would be cool if it turns out that it is important for whatever reason that, you know, I couldn't really imagine. Okay, then we see Emmett. He's being led to this community cell, and he looks none too happy about it. And he sits alone, and he looks kind of all intimidated, and a big, huge guy comes up to him and says, "Nice sweater," and he corrects the guy that it's a cardigan.
Well, or affirms, "Yeah, you're right, it's nice. Damn right it's nice, it's cardigan."
I thought that was so funny that he would even think of that in this situation. He's locked in this community cell with for murder, and that's what comes to mind. Okay, then Winnie gets a phone call from Gloria, who she can't hear, and Winnie's trying to tell her about the murder of a new Stussy, and Gloria's talking about why Goldfarb said Emmett was there with her at the time of the murder, when Emmett's just confessed that he was the murderer.
Right, and why was there an alibi if there didn't need to be one?
Right, and that's a good question, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But Winnie's saying this is a dentist who lives on a nice, quiet street and had a piece of glass stuck in his neck, and his name was Stussy. And it was really interesting because the conversation, Gloria is really talking about one thing, and Winnie is really talking about something else entirely. And I just absolutely love conversations like that. It's like you can get two whole conversations out of this one thing. So I thought that was
kind of
cool.
they psychically pull it off. They feminine intuitionally, whatever, the way feminine intuition works, they understand each other even though they're not connecting verbally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was great. Yeah, I think I think it shows us that they really do, they are hitting it off for sure. Okay, then we go to the scene where Nathan has taken a bus to have a burger dinner with his mom. He's brought her burgers and everything. And she's doing this, you know, "I still want to do things with you like when you were little. Let's go up to the lake this weekend and go canoeing." But he'd rather go to the mall. And she's like, "What? The mall in place of canoeing?" Donnie comes in and tells her that she has a phone call and he gets fries for his trouble. We know Donnie's
always... By the way, Michelle, this scene is exactly like Margie having lunch with her husband in Fargo the movie. He's sitting at her desk. She comes in from somewhere outside, and he's already like planted himself at her desk at lunchtime. He's bought her lunch. She's happy to see him. It's such another nod directly to the movie that it's like uncanny.
That's interesting. Was that the time that that he or she had went to meet up with somebody or something and she felt guilty or something?
Yeah, that, I'm trying I think to remember. That might have been that after that Mike Yanagata scene, which was like where she realized, he's lying to me. So the other guy's lying to me too.
Mm-hmm.
He's
mm-hmm.
fooling me. He's pulling one over on me. By the way, in the movie, Margie's husband, did we talk about this before? His biggest score in life was that his art got named to a stamp.
Oh, that's really good. Yes, it did. You're right. That was the end of the movie, wasn't it?
That's nothing new to anybody who's ever read it about any of this Fargo stuff, but I don't think you and I have ever talked about it.
No, but I haven't never even thought about it, that it had to do with a stamp. So that's really, really cool.
And
I like that.
And I think a 2-cent stamp, because he's like, it's the 2-cent stamp. It's not even the 18-cent real stamp. She's like, well, people need 2-cent stamps if they only have 6. She's like really supportive and encouraging to him.
Right.
And then, of course, here's the 2-cent stamp in this season.
That is really great. I had not thought about that. That's really, really great. Okay, so on the phone, we assume it's the Widow Goldfarb because she's talking about you know, meeting with her and thank you for meeting with me and doing all this. And then she says she's just kicking the tires on the Emmett confession.
So, Michelle, before Widow Goldfarb calls, I would have expected you to have like a heartwarming 5 minutes on this. Because with Gloria and Nathan, because Gloria suggests going to the lake, and he's not that excited. He's like, oh, I could go to the mall, you know, I'll go with my friends. And then she says, it's just us. It's just you and me. It's not like you, me, and Dad and his boyfriend. And then he gets all really excited about it, and he's really into it. I thought that would have, like, blown you over. Like, oh, that was so sweet of Nathan and Gloria making that connection, and he just wants to be with his mom, and...
I didn't think that's what was said. I thought she said it's just you and me, not your friends, because he was talking about his friends. And then he said, oh, okay, we'll go, because he felt like it hurt her feelings.
I don't know why the ex-husband would be going with them to the lake house, but I took it that way. And for some reason, he turned. Like, wow, this is really better, this new way that I didn't think of. I didn't think that's what you meant, Mom, but if you mean this way, just you and me, then I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay, that's the coolest thing ever. Not that scene, but the fact that you saw it that way and I saw it completely different. I saw it as him feeling sorry for his mom. And I think we see her feel sorry for herself a little bit. Not that she didn't have reason to, but I felt like that she's... And she... you know, kind of feel sorry for herself with Winnie. She feels sorry for herself with Emmett, even. And I felt like she was kind of feeling sorry for herself here. I really didn't take it that way at all.
Do you think they crafted it that way to be, like, uncertain about who she meant more than just her and Nathan, who those other parties would be, so that people would question it like that?
Or maybe people would put their own spin on it, you know, like take it how it means to them, because that is interesting. That's the most interesting part of that scene, is that you saw it completely that way, and I saw it completely a different way.
Yeah, I thought you would make a total point about it, like, oh, Michelle's going to love this part, that he's just happy to be with his mom at the lake.
No, see, I felt sorry for her, because I felt, first of all, having raised teenagers, I, you know, definitely felt sorry for her in that... You know, you still want them to be little. You want to be able to say, hey, let's go get an ice cream or whatever you might say, and them go, yay, and they just don't anymore.
Yeah, although he's very coolly done what Margie's husband did and surprised his mom with lunch. So he's a pretty cool son to his mom already.
Yeah, and you know... I know I keep forgetting that this stuff is really new. This isn't years old. When it first came out, I felt like it was years old, the separation between Gloria and her husband, and it's not. It's not even a year. And how hard that would be on a kid like Nathan at that age and that time with everything. I don't know, but that's very interesting. But Gloria says two times in this scene, and I almost thought it might have been like an error, but I wonder if it wasn't. But twice in this little tiny scene, she says, I might finally be able to put this thing to bed. She says it twice.
Why is that an error?
I don't know. I didn't know if maybe, you know, she was supposed to say it once and then she ended up saying it again in another part of it, in another take or something, because it just seemed like in this little... two maybe minute scene, she said that twice, and I didn't know if it had some kind of more significant meaning or not.
I think that's just the resolution of her job. Her role in life is to solve crimes, and this could be the solution to this crime.
Yeah, but to say it twice.
Well, that maybe emphasizes how important it was to her.
Well, yeah, and maybe she was you know, I thought maybe she was saying it to tell Nathan, I'm not going to be working so hard, I'll have more time, or whatever, but...
I don't think that. I think it's this may be finally being brought to resolution, even in the face of all these frickin' men who are, like, blocking my way and trying to make this harder than it needs to be. This might finally, you know, be settled.
How frustrating. Well, I mean, we'll get to it in a minute, but good grief.
Don't talk mo.
We see Mo and Donnie going into the new Stussy murder victim's house, and Hans Murderlach is there. And this guy has his mouth and his nose glued shut, and the freezer door's open. It's the exact same thing that happened in Ennis' house.
Yeah, so that means we know that Varga was connected to Ennis, because nobody would have known the freezer door was open.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't think everybody... I mean, you're right. This is not just a Mo, right? This is not just them trying to make it look like something, although they obviously are. But it's more than that, correct?
Well, it means Varga had something to do with Ennis.
Because, see, we thought Yuri did. And, I mean, of course, if Yuri did, then Yuri did.
Well, Yuri's Varga.
That's Varga, right. But would Yuri have come back and given that much detail to Varga? Because, see, Yuri's not here anymore.
Well, maybe Varga told him to do that to start with.
To leave the freezer door open? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like you're staring into the abyss, the cold. What, you know, this isn't a guy taking over a company for money. This is a philosophical adventure. What happens when you die? What happens when evil confronts good? Who wins when, you know, can you just believe a lie and go on through life? And if you believe it, does the lie go away? It's like more philosophical than actual.
Well, I wish somebody would give Mo a little bit of philosophy training, because he is just very black and white in the whole thing. He's very, you know, I can see it, so this is what it is. It can't be anything else. He says this is a serial killer that's altering his mo to throw the police off.
Brilliant.
You're right, right. And then Donnie comes in and says that a maroon Cadillac, the neighbor saw it speeding off right before the wife got home, and they happened to get the plate of it, amazingly enough. Oh, and by the way, there is a fingerprint left in glue in the house.
That's a good way to preserve it.
Yeah. So then we see Mo pull up on a maroon Cadillac, and there is an Asian-looking man who says it's about time, which could definitely have been, you know, in a speed chase identified as Mimo.
It's a jumbo-sized Mimo.
Yeah.
With a scar in his cheek. Michelle, how many things have to cross paths? Like, this was Citizen V in Breaking Bad. He caught the guy that caught Badger, the Jimmy In and Out, who was the guy in Breaking Bad who went to prison on purpose for enough money. This is what this jumbo Mimo is. I think his name is Bao Wu. They call him later. Bao Wu.
Donald, or... Yeah, something.
Donald Wu?
It was something weird.
I thought Bao Wu. I didn't have captions. I was just trying to hear it.
Yeah.
But this is a Jimmy In and Out, right? He's a guy that gets paid enough to go take the fall for the crime. And
how much would you have to get paid for something like that?
Well, he did. I don't know.
And, you know, we don't even know how much of the story that we hear about him later on is even... I mean, you know, probably not a lot of it's even correct.
Isn't that ironic, though, that was Citizen Z, who was the cop that stung Badger, that created the need for the Jimmy In and Out and Breaking Bad, that was a totally different show, but it was a J.D. Quayle's part that he played. I don't know. I just thought that was weird that was such a similar type of role for this In and Out. Bao Wu is now the In and Out guy.
They do this kind of stuff, and it's amazing to me how they can pull together all of this and find like common themes to run through it. I agree. I think it's crazy. Okay, so they've gotten the guy, and he's going to take the fall. And I questioned here, at least for a little while or something. I didn't know if it's going to be like a lifetime fall or not, but we have to assume. And then we get like this sepia moment where the Widow Goldfarb pulls her swanky car into the Meeker County Sheriff's Department. And she immediately starts qualifying anything she's going to say to Gloria, because memories fade over time. And she was very clear with the other officer. And she asked if this is a murder. And then she goes into the fact that she ended up having dinner because Buck Olander, the banker, agreed to introduce her to people. She didn't want to tell her she was from St. Cloud. I think you were right about the Widow Gold Farm, by the way.
Well, that's funny you say that, because I think I'm wrong now. Why do you think I'm right?
I think you're right.
What do you think I'm right about?
I think she's in with Varga.
Yeah, see, I thought she was a force that would be ultimately against Varga, but now I'm pretty positive that she's working with Varga.
Yeah, I just think that she's not who she, you know, she's not.
Well,
and
she's definitely that, not who she appears to be.
Well, right. And see, they were both introduced by this Buck guy, remember? Because that's how they got the money to begin with. That's how they were introduced to the Ermentraub guy, who ended up being or being connected to Varga. And then this same Buck guy, was the one who, you got to get in touch with the Widow Gold Farm. You got to do it. She's got all this money. She wants to put it in here and all this. So
who do you think the Widow Gold Farm is? Define her for me.
She's something to do with Varga, I believe. I mean, she could be anything to do with him. I don't know, but I don't really have anything deeper than that. Did you?
Yeah, I think she's another supernatural. I think Varga's a supernatural force, and I think Goldfarb is too. She's very evasive in her conversation here with Gloria. She's like animal evasive. Like, you're from where? Doesn't matter. St. Louis. She's like unhuman, inhuman, whatever. She's machine-like. She's like a robot. She parrots back these, you know, the penny saved is a penny earned. It rains when it pours. That's a cliche. Like, she's educating the mere mortal Gloria in these. It's like she's robotic. Like, she's not really good at being a human, but she's trying to be. And she doesn't understand, like, oh, well, everybody would know that. You don't have to tell Gloria that's a cliche. She already knows that. But I don't know. I think she's some weird corpsey / robotic-y bit player for Varga. Almost more than, different than human. Maybe not more than human, but different than human. Like DJ Squales, or Quails was the golem, the clay figure. She's almost like that.
But do you think we're actually going to find out in the next episode that Varga and the Widow Goldfarb and all of these people are actually not human?
I don't know. We didn't really ever find out that Malva wasn't human, but I think probably he wasn't. You never found out that Chigurh wasn't human, but probably he wasn't. I don't think we need that much definition to have a very good ending to this.
No, but I mean, I think with Widow Goldfarb, we need more. I agree with Varga, and like with Chigurh and with Malvo, that's okay because they were the main characters. But now, like with the Widow Goldfarb, I want more information on her if she's going to end up being, you know.
Well, with Malvo, you got to, you know, you think, wow, he escaped from the basement. There's no possible way he could have done that, and then Colin Hanks kills him, so he was human. So you got to just kind of go, that was interesting, and that's all you're ever going to get from it.
Right.
That might be all we ever get from Goldfarb, but I don't think she's a widow investing and making money. I think she's a force in good or evil, probably more towards the evil side.
But I think we're going to find out that what her connection is, and I hope we do. We have to know something. We have to know more than just this vagary that we've gotten.
Maybe.
But they discuss Zahn, what happened to him, and that she had heard about that. Evidently, it's just believed that Zah had just fallen ill, and I didn't know that that's really what they were thinking. But I guess there wouldn't be any reason to think otherwise, but that was kind of weird. And then they go into the fact that she says Sai arrived first, and then Gloria starts to ask her how long before Emmett gets there, but there's a ruckus in the hallway, And this is where Mo is coming in saying he solved it. And he goes into the fact that they have two new murders in St. Cloud exactly like her murders. And come on. This guy had mail in his trunk from Ennis House, which that proves right there, right? That proves that Varga had something to do with that.
Well, VM Varga's plan has worked. He's essentially, we can shorten all this, Michelle. He's going to get Emmett out of jail, back into his clutches.
Well, yeah, but this is important, though. It's important, the things that Mo is falling for. Because if you were going to plant something, how could you plant?
Mo's an idiot. He's a credit-grabbing idiot. That explains it. You don't have to go much deeper than that.
I guess. But, this is like if there had been like a video, a badly edited, photoshopped video of it or something, a framed photo of Ray and Nikki, a trunk full of blood and super glue, and the guy confesses on the ride over, crying like a baby. His name was Donald Wu. That was his name. And he served 22 years for beating a guy's skull in, and he lives under the highway since he's gotten out. His mom's boyfriend's name was Stussy, and he used to molest him.
Yep, so VMV did his homework and got what he wanted.
But who would even believe that?
Mo,
I guess. Well, Mo tells her that Emmett feels guilty, which is what we've already talked about, because he fought with his loser brother all these years, and Gloria believes it's because, and that he thinks Gloria believes it because she didn't like Emmett, and she wants to believe it. And then he says, cut him loose, that's an order. Well, Gloria goes back into the Widow Goldfarb, and who's telling her she's got to leave now. And then Gloria asks her about how long afterward did Emmett get there. And this is where she said 5 minutes, and Gloria said, well, you said 30 minutes before. And then essentially she said, if you have any more questions, you can contact my attorney.
Yeah, she has a super dreamy affectation. She's not like a person here. You're right. You said 5 minutes, you said before was a half hour. Well, then it must have been a half an hour. You know how the memory can play tricks. That's another that's another cliche. Like, that's the robot. That's like the robot from episode 3 or whatever.
Yeah, you know, just android.
Not knowing, a human knows this, dude. You're trying to pretend to be a human, but you're trying too hard. I don't know. She seemed weird. She seemed so weird that she has to be something weird.
Yeah, and she's definitely in on this in some way. Because Gloria specifically asked her, she said, are you covering for him?
Right. So she might be some sort of a messenger, like the Paul was for Nikki or something. She may be a messenger of some sort for Gloria. Or she may just be an evil golem that is another one of Varga's, puppets.
Well, the next we see VMV eating a huge container of Rocky Road on a commode. And, he is really, first of all, that's really just not the place you want to go to eat, right? And he is, like, shoveling this down. Have you ever eaten ice cream too fast?
No, never, Michelle. I don't know how he did this
even in the scene. It had to have been, like, whipped cream or something, right, in place of ice cream. He was just shoveling this ice-cold ice cream down. I was waiting on him to, like, get brain freeze and... But
well,
we know
the worst. The worst part of that whole scene was the sound. The sound was horrendous.
The sound and knowing what was going to come next, which they didn't show us, but they didn't have to. That ice cream wasn't going to stay. But we hear Mimo come in and say it's done. They're letting him out, and then he says Doyle will drive you to meet the Swango. They call her the Swango, which I think is kind of funny.
Stage 5.
Yeah, we're going into stage 5. Okay, so then this is where Varga meets Nikki in the empty Clarion lobby. When he walks in, she says, I loved you in Death of a Salesman, I guess because of the way he was dressed.
Yeah, he's dressed
pretty
with
pretty funny.
And also, Nikki starts the conversation. People always wait for Varga to take the lead, and she takes the lead. This is really, really cool setting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. This was a pretty good conversation that they had, too. But it was hilarious how she started out like that. Oh, and he even says, hilarious, you know.
Hilarious.
He asks if she wants tea. And, you know, we're all just really hoping she says no. So
what about that? That's actually kind of important, I think, that that's the poison tea, Cinderella. Cinderella's the one who fell asleep, right? Or Sleeping Beauty. That's the poison tea. You want some? No, thanks. But he drinks the tea and he's fine. So what does that mean about VM Varga?
Did he actually drink it or did he just make it? Okay.
Yeah, he drank it.
Okay, that's a good point.
He's not human, damn it.
Okay. And then she brings up, do you know why I chose this place? And now, you want to talk about a heartwarming moment. My heart was warmed with this moment. Because if we had ever doubted, say that we've doubted the whole time that she really loved Ray, her picking this place absolutely meant that she loved Ray.
Well, right. They hammered it down with this for sure. So if we didn't get it with the cat, you get it with this.
Right.
But I also think it's the strategy. It's important to realize that Nikki's not just some ex-con. She's a smart tactician here and that she's... There's a strong bridge analogy, but she plays Varga just like he was playing bridge with her, and Ray and her partner is, you know, I said Ray, but Wrench is her partner. She can't see his hand, but she trusts his hand, and you know and Mimo and Varga are against Nikki and Wrench. It's a bridge. It's totally cool, and it's right at the scene of their third showing. What do they call it? Third runner-up, which is really fourth place, but we still call it third place. I think that's a mistake, but...
Yeah, for the Wildcat Regionals, she brings up. And this is where she's telling him that it's, you know, bridge, and starts talking about the nuances of bridge. And he says he's never understood playing games. It's repulsive. And we know for a fact that's all this man does, right, is play games. That's all he does. But he makes that comment. And then she says strategy was her. That's what she was good at. And then he offers her his mother's recipe tea, like you said. And he's got the money, but he'd like to offer her a job instead. Which
right.
was...
But that's okay. Like saying, I have something good. She has to evaluate it. Like, is this true or not? Like, he's bidding in bridge. No, I don't believe that. I don't believe you have even the money in the case. So I think she even uses 60% later on. I've reduced mm-hmm. it to about 60% that you actually have money in there. Or 60% that it's dirty underwear or something.
Right.
So 40% that I would actually get something out of this. So I'm not gonna put my power into this because there's no payoff. It's a bridge hand. It's really cool the way they did it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely a, like a jousting, you know, they were definitely vying for top spot in this. But did you think he would have really offered her a job?
No.
Do you think that's what it, no, you don't think so? Because I don't know, because he respects that kind of intelligence.
Well, he oddly keeps adding zeros, like you just added a zero to your salary.
Right.
You just added two zeros to your salary. That's like almost zero zeros. It's like there's nothing. There's zero there. I don't know. I think it was kind of a cute Hollyism that there's no real offer there.
Okay, I really wasn't sure. I mean, I did not think she would do
He's
it.
Trying to give her the tea. Do you give the tea to the person you want to hire?
Well, I mean, maybe if you're stupid enough to take the tea, then you know, in his mind, then he wouldn't want to hide. I don't know.
He would have slapped the tea out of her hand at the last second.
Maybe. But he says that the company he works for is called Narwhal. And I just thought that was funny because, you know, Narwhal is that, like a, they call them unicorns of the sea, right? They're these big, beautiful creatures with the long, I think the males have the long tusk protruding from their head. So that's just almost like a mythical creature, but except narwhals are not mythical. I don't think.
It's the unicorn of the sea. Unicorn of the sea, Michelle. It's a whale. The narwhale. And it's got shortened to narwhal. But yeah, that's the name. We've heard that name before, too, of his company. We heard that right at the very beginning.
Yeah, and it kind of rung a bell with that. But I thought it was funny that it's, you know, you just, I don't know. I just thought it was funny. But she says that she knows a boss when she sees one, that he does not work for them. Right. And that's where he goes, you know, you just added a zero to. And she says Sherry has a job blackmailing him. And then she goes into the 60% chance that his briefcase has dirty underwear. And then she goes on into the guy must, your guy must be somewhere with hardware on her. And there's a good chance that if she brought the stuff that she's trading him the money for, that his guy's going to shoot her. And then she calls him distinctive. And what do you think about that?
There was a parrying here. They were parrying back and forth. You call it a dueling or a sword fight. It is a little bit like that. And he says, distinctive. And then there's a bunch of other guys that look just like him that he's set up. So she realizes that, and she's like even credits him for that. Like, ah, touche. Good one. Good
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Good parry. good stab. Good thrust with your sword. But
there's even another girl in there that looks like her.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, there's another guy sitting within his trench coat with another girl that looks like her. So it's crazy the trouble that he went to and the lengths that he went to. But at this time, we see Wrench go behind Mimo, who, of course, has had a gun aimed on her. And he puts a gun to Mimo's head and then signals her. Okay.
Well, you got to preface that with the immensely perfect dialogue to it. Because he says, right after he says, she says, well, you're distinctive. And he says, really? Take a look around. And it's all, you know, there's a couple other trench coat guys. She says, nice. So he says, he insults her. He says, that Wildcat Regional was an amateur affair. And she says, semi-professional. And then that's the very moment that Wrench pulls the gun on Mimo. So he underestimates her. And she corrects him right at the time where she's saying semi-professional. Wrench gets the one up on Mimo. So, aha. It's like she got one up on VMV. That timing was perfect.
It was. It was great. And then, you know, she's kind of covering up the little thing she's got in her ear with her hair because she's been signaled about this. And now she just wants her money. But he's like, well, you just added two more zeros to your salary. So I think he knew how he knew, I don't know. But I think he knew that she had put an end to her potential, you know, Mimo hurting her. Did you get that?
Well, or the fact that he's seeing that she's not going to go for the job and she's not going to go for the money, that his plan isn't working, so he's giving her credit. I don't think he could know anything about Mimo getting a gun pulled on him.
I think he knew. I think he knew that he had lost the upper hand, and I don't know how, and there's no reason for me to say that other than the fact that he just kind of conceded to her.
Well, the fact that she's answering every single thing he normally wins with people when he threateningly talks to people. She's like, you were an amateur in this. And she's like, semi-professional, dick. You don't call me an amateur. She's like matching him stride for stride. And he's like, all right, you're right. You moved up an elevate. I'm elevating you up a strategic class as a foe to me.
Well, she wants to hurt him. She says, not be his pet. Look him in the face and rip out something he loves. And then she calls him Willie Loman, the guy from Death of a Salesman, which is what, you know, she had talked about earlier.
Yeah, that's another nod to Ray, too, that I'm going to rip out something you love because you ripped out Ray from me.
Right. But Vargas says that he didn't kill Ray. It was Emmett. So he just throws Emmett completely under the bus here. And she says, but Emmett's not the one who came for me in the precinct or flipped the bus. And then he says, well, I just dislike you now. You know, it's like she's went too far now because he's not able to schmooze her with talk, or he's not able to get one over on her. He's not able to offer her a job. He's not able to do anything. She's not having any of it.
And she loves it. I'm good. I'm glad you dislike me. You have till tomorrow to get me my money.
Right. And she gets up and walks away, and Wrench is right by her side. Now, I assumed here that Mimo was gone.
I don't know that.
He's not. But I didn't see why Wrench would have left him alive in that instance. Because if it had worked out the other way, Mimo, we've seen Mimo, and he would not blink an eye at have literally shot Nikki in the head in the middle of that deserted hotel lobby.
Well, he didn't kill her when they beat her up in the parking lot.
No, he didn't. But, you know, she didn't kill them by throwing a real grenade in the truck. Of course, that would have kind of defeated her purpose. Yeah. But, you know, there's been instances that
She wants to harm him, not kill him. Killing him is too merciful. She wants to take away something valuable from him and make him feel pain.
Right. But if you have, you know, if you have somebody like Mimo who's going around killing somebody just because their name is Stussy, just to get Emmett out of the police station where he's went to confess, I'm not sure that getting... I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, I mean, should you, if you have the opportunity and the motive and everything, it just doesn't seem like in this context it would be horrible, right? Or is it in
horrible
that way?
For Wrench to kill Mima?
Yeah. I mean, would it be unfair? Unfair
no,
in the
but
context
it's not,
of everything?
They're not after fair. She's after winning this victory that's more than just money. It's more than just money. It's like ripping something important from him.
Well, I mean,
she
I completely
understand
that.
She probably told Mimo, whatever you... Or not Mimo. She probably told Wrench, whatever you do, don't kill him. Just, you know, disable him so that we don't get harmed in this, and we'll walk out and we'll go to our plan B.
Okay, well, then we go to the next scene where Donnie brings Emmett to Gloria in the interrogation room, and she goes into this whole thing. She tells her whole story here about how she got married out of high school. She had known him since fifth grade. They've got a teenager now, and her husband phones her last year at work and tells her he has a boyfriend named Dale, and they're moving in together. He loves her, but not like that. And then she's really sad. She's really pitiful here. And she says, you think the world is something, and it turns out to be something else. And then she says, you're free to go.
Yeah.
And he thinks he's being treated that way because he has money. But she tells him about the two other Stussies that have been murdered, which, of course, freaks him out because he knows on some level this is his fault. Because he came in there to confess, Varga has went and done this other stuff.
Right, so we got to watch our time, Michelle, so we don't go to another 2 hour here. So, yeah, the result of this, it gets Emmett out of jail, which is what VMware gets him right back into his clutches. She tells a cute little story about she didn't believe the husband, or she thought the husband was real and they had a son and it was a storybook, and then he turns out he's, like, gay. And that got Emmett out of jail. This fake other crime got somebody else collected for it.
And then she asked him, though. She asked him, who's doing this? She, you know, the lady shoe salesman that was in your office, and he won't tell her anything.
Yeah, why do you think he doesn't tell her?
Because he's scared. He's scared of Varga. Mm-hmm, I think so. Because he stammers a little bit, and then he just won't tell her. And then we see Emmett walking out, and he's got his little bag of belongings, and he gets in the car. Mimo's waiting on him, and Mimo gives this really, like, ugly smile to Gloria, kind of like, we won. And Varga's in the back. This was a crazy statement. He goes, the problem isn't that there's evil in the world. The problem is that there's good. Otherwise, who would care?
Yeah, the problem is not that there's evil. It's that there's good.
Right.
So that's
right.
The gist of this whole thing, I think. The whole Fargo series and Fargo movie. If there wasn't good to stop evil, you know, who would care? The real problem for the evildoers is that there's good.
Well, then we see the rare treat of Winnie and Gloria out of uniform, and they meet up in the bar, and Winnie goes into a whole, she shouldn't be drinking during ovulation. She goes into a lot of really kind of crude TMI. Conversation. Yeah. And then Gloria starts to tell her about Ennis' book, The Planet Y, and all the android can say is, I can help, but he couldn't. And that's how she feels. Invisible or not real, surreal. And then she goes into talking to her about how doors don't work, sensors don't sense her, and that no one can hear her on the phone, and that she has a theory that she doesn't even exist. And Winnie eventually gets her to stand up, and she gives her a really good hug, and Gloria starts crying. Gloria goes to the bathroom to get cleaned up, and what do you know? The sensors work.
So what's the lesson there, Michelle? Why does Winnie believing in Gloria and making her believe that she's a real person, why does that finally get the technology to work? How is that? That's a gap that I had trouble jumping.
Yeah. I don't know how long sensors haven't worked for Gloria. You know, I'm assuming that maybe sensors haven't worked since her husband left. And, you know, she felt like she said, unreal. She didn't feel like a real person because the world wasn't what she thought it was. I mean, you know, as far as physically how that would work, I mean, come on, there is no physical reason. But suddenly with that hug, she felt really connected to this person, and that gave her maybe a little bit of her self back, would be my only guess. I don't know.
Start to believe in yourself and the world starts to work for you.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. Can you buy that in any way? I actually had it down to ask, you know, what you took.
The meaning. I guess it's another one of those non-literal things, like, okay, I'm really real. She can feel me as she hugs me, so now the real water dispenser will work. It's more philosophical than real.
Sure. Then we go with the IRS dude. LaRue Dollard, he's walking in with his sack lunch. He gets to the office, sprays down his plant, and finds a package in there. And this package happens to be a huge package of Stussy accounts, paperwork, and a hard drive.
Yeah, Stussy accounting, the reports of their income.
Yep. Okay, who sent that?
Nikki.
Was it Nikki?
Or Wrench. I mean, that's what they got out of the semi-truck on the computer drives. All the fake financial reports.
But was that the fake or was that the real?
Neither one. It's the evidence the IRS can use to say, you showed me the fake, here's the real, or you showed me the real, here's the fake, whatever. It's the undoing of the plot of VM okay. Varga.
Well, I thought it could have been Emmett as well. Because he was over it, too, and had already went to confess, and he didn't want, you know, of course, Varga to run his business when he was in jail.
I don't know that Emmett has access to that stuff, though. He doesn't have access to maybe. But after Wrench and Nikki ransacked the truck to get the data, it seemed like that's what the data contained, those reports.
Yeah, but you wouldn't think she would do that before she got the money. That doesn't make any sense.
She doesn't want the money, though. She wants to hurt him.
She does, but she wants the money, too. She definitely, Nikki wants the money. She may want to hurt him, too, but I will always believe that Nikki's after the money.
Well, okay. Maybe. What has she been doing for 3 months in hiding from December to March?
I don't know. Next week, the finale, Somebody to Love. The little clip under it on IMDb said, Gloria follows the money. Nikki plays a game. Emmett learns a lesson about progress from Varga.
So did you watch the preview video?
Always. We see Nikki and Wrench with an arsenal of weapons, and Nikki's racking a rifle of some sort.
Yeah, shotgun.
Yeah. Gloria is looking at pictures and saying she doesn't know him, which is Wrench. And Winnie says, well, you're sure to know the next one, and the next one's Nikki. Gloria answers the phone, and the FBI guy asks her if she's working a case involving, or not the FBI, the IRS guy, asks her if she's working a case involving Emmett Stussy and a VM Varga. And Gloria, in a separate thing, Gloria says, "Don't move, I'll be right there." Then we see Emmett, and he's got the Sisyphus stamp on his forehead, of all things. Right. We see VMV at his computer setup. We see VMV standing over Emmett, who has his head down on the table, and he's saying, "We see it all the time in the wild, a smaller animal going limp." We see Emmett stomping something in the road. It looks like it might be a gun, even though that makes no sense. Maybe it's a phone or something. Winnie is giving Gloria what she's, is asking Gloria what she's going to do. And she says, "Somebody's got to warn Emmett." So something's going on with Emmett. We see three men with serious weapons walking through a living room, foyer area. It looks like they're in unison. Well, it's almost like a dance or something. We see Emmett backing up saying, "You work for Varga?" And I'm just really wondering if he's not talking to the Widow Gold Varga.
Yeah, of course he is. Yeah. I actually watched this one, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
and we see Nikki point a gun and looking nervous. On the extended clip of next week that we see on Facebook, Fargo FX Facebook page, we see the scene where the FBI guy, Dollard, is on the phone with Gloria, and the room is huge. He's in this huge, like, office room, and paperwork is lining every square inch of this room. And he asks her about her, excuse me, about her case, and she says they don't have one anymore on Emmett, and is telling her that it looks like Emmett's borrowed upwards of $200 million to line the pockets of himself, Cy, and Varga. And Gloria asks him to repeat that last name, like it sounds familiar to her. And he says he doesn't know what the VM stands for.
Hmm.
Now, what if Gloria knows Varga? Because remember, she's tried to get his name this whole time, and she hasn't been able to get it. Remember, she asked him, and he doesn't give it to her. She asked Emmett his name. Emmett won't give it to her. And when Dollard tells her, the IRS guy says Varga, she acts like she recognizes the name.
Well, why would she know Varga?
That's what I don't know.
She recognizes the name because it's new to the IRS guy, but it's not new to her.
It is new to her. She doesn't know the name Varga, right? She's asking him in this episode. She's asking Emmett his name, the mastermind, the woman's shoe guy. She does not know his name.
Hmm.
Anyway.
Didn't she do that earlier in this 309, though, ask what the VM and the VM Varga was?
No, that was Nikki.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Gloria has not heard his name yet.
Well, VM, very mysterious.
Varga. It sure is.
All right, Michelle, well, we're going to try our best to avoid the editing debacle. So,
yes, 309 sorry.
Emporia, next week 310, Somebody to Love. That's about it, right?
That's it. That's it. We're done.
We'll come in for a good landing. I'm pretty confident.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would be really surprised if it didn't.
Who's going to be loved? Who needs somebody to love?
Gloria. Maybe Emmett.
Maybe everybody.
Maybe everybody, yep. You're right.
All right, Michelle, talk to you then. We'll figure it out.
Okay, see you then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.